Part of your purpose is setting clear boundaries of what you're in a position to give, what you're not in a position to give, and what you won't or can't give because it would hurt you to do so. Before you can figure out how you want to profit, you have to discern why you want to be a connector and then align your goals with that. You also want to use your time wisely. Think about it. We're all juggling 12 different things at once. You have to pick and choose where to focus your energy. I don't think that the idea of investing your time has to be a negative or transactional way of thinking about it, says Michael Ellsberg. As long as you're taking the broader view of investing your time with a return of value for yourself, for the other person, and for your values and your mission in the world. Trust in other people's judgment. While you'll get many opportunities from your network, depending on whom you talk to, you need to almost score the relationship. How long and how well do you know the other person? What's your track record with them? Do you trust that they have your best interests at heart? Ingrid Vandervelt, IV, built and sold two ventures and helped countless other entrepreneurs build, grow, and exit theirs. She also became the first ever entrepreneur in residence, EIR, at Dell. In that role, she used what she learned in the trenches of business to help other entrepreneurs, and now she is on a mission to empower 1 billion women by 2020. Her path to EIR started with an almost declined invitation. Due to a hectic schedule, Vandervelt would field dozens of invitations a week. She had to pick and choose which ones were worth her time. So when she was invited to the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, DWEN, she was ready to skip it due to other obligations, until a longtime friend and fellow entrepreneur, Heidi Messer, called her and said, "You really need to do this, Ivy." Ivy always trusted Heidi's judgment, and so she went. She ended up meeting the top brass at Dell, including Steve Felice, Dell's COO, and the relationships she built at DWEN are what led to her EIR gig a year later. All the superconnectors we've talked to became connectors to build a community. But with the help of their community, each one of them also made connections that would help them later. When John Levy's book came out, he called on the media relationships he had cultivated at his dinners to help him with press. Steve Sims and John Rulin's kindness has netted them millions of dollars in client contracts. Jason Gaynard's community loves what he built so much, they spend thousands of dollars annually to be a part of his event series. David Cohen's network has enabled him to create one of the top startup accelerators in the world, offering him and his colleagues investment opportunities in some of the premier companies in the world. Jim Pierce built a practice and a community around him. Michael Ellsberg was able to publish a book that went gangbusters for his career. You get the idea. There is a reason the top business people in the world continue to work together time and again. Trust. Integrity. Powerful bonds. Longer-term, successful people are going to want to work with and help other successful people. So it's important that early on, they identify you as someone who has the ambition and drive to be ambitious. It's good to have vision, passion, and motivation for what you do, and many people will want to help you achieve that success. You just need to go about it the right way and not bastardize your relationships. Indeed, we all know people who see others as mere stepping stones. For them, people are instruments to help them climb the ladder. As soon as they get to where they need to be, boom, they disappear. These are the same sorts of people who call only when they need something. Nothing sucks more than feeling used. One thing is clear. If you follow the ideas we've laid out in this book, in a few short years, you will have assembled the right community of amazing people around you. If you do everything we suggest, many of the right people are going to want your attention or will send things your way. So it's important to consider all the ways in which your superconnecting skills work for you. Adam Grant believes that in every workplace, there are three basic kinds of people: givers, takers, and matchers. The most successful and least successful people are both givers. How is this possible? The main difference is that the ones on the top have learned to say no sometimes. The ones at the bottom try to do for everybody. They give and give and get nothing in return. That is decidedly not smart. It's about being thoughtful about who you help, how you help, and when you help, says Grant. What we see with failed givers is that they try to help all the people all the time with all the requests, and they end up sacrificing their own success as, you know, they devote so much time and energy to help others that they fall behind on their own work. They get exploited by more selfish takers, and they end up contributing in ways that are actually not all that effective. Whereas what you see with successful givers is they say, look, I'm not going to help everybody equally. If somebody has a history or a reputation of selfish behavior, then I'm going to shift more into matching mode and hold them accountable for paying it back or paying it forward. And that way, I get to reserve my generosity for people who are fair or are themselves generous. Bottom line, if you try to be everything to everyone, you likely won't be anything to anyone. Ryan and I are exceptions to one particular rule, that it's a good idea to build a business out of your community. They rarely succeed. We aren't saying don't do it, but we are saying that there are many other easier ways to profit as a result of your network. We did not become superconnectors to make money. We became superconnectors because we really like introducing people to each other. We live for it. It's second nature to us. But while introductions are a fun endorphin-induced high, the real reason we became superconnectors is because we know that the right people coming together can create wonderful outcomes. Not only is it beneficial from a business perspective, but it might also be life-enhancing. A July 2008 study in the American Journal of Public Health found that strong social ties may actually promote brain health. We will probably never know if our lives are extended because Dan Chabelle introduced us, but we do know that our lives would have been less full. So would yours. You wouldn't be listening to this audiobook. Which doesn't mean that we don't think about money. We're not stupid. We have 6 children between us, along with mortgages and car payments and dental bills. We want to earn a living, and then some. We would be lying if we said there isn't financial gain to all of this. There certainly can be. However, you don't want to make money off your connections, but rather profit as a result of doing well by them. So it's okay to think about money. It's okay to think about yourself to some extent. Profiting should come as a result of aggregate efforts rather than one relationship. It's not that we should be selfish, but we should remain mindful of our own needs as well as other people's. We were eventually able to turn relationship building into a business, but that did not happen for many years, and not until we realized that we were good at it. If you re-listen to this audiobook, you will notice that not one person we spoke to said they got into it in order to make a lot of money. They said, "This is my life's passion and purpose. I love it, and if I can help people and also make money, all the better." Different ways to benefit. So how do you make money as a superconnector? Let's say you are at a job. If you are seen as a team player, that is, someone who will help the organization more effectively, you will have a better chance of climbing the ladder. You'll be seen as integral to the growth of the organization. Profiting comes in a variety of shapes and forms. Profiting is not necessarily about financial reward, or any material reward for that matter. Nor is it about profiting from a single transaction. Anjula Acharya, a partner at Trinity Ventures, an investment firm in San Francisco, benefited greatly by getting a major career opportunity through her network. Acharya came to the United States from England with no contacts at all. but she built a network that created opportunities for her to work with people like Lady Gaga and Britney Spears, and struck her first deal in the music business with Edgar Bronfman, then CEO of Warner Music Group. One of her mentors is visionary music man Jimmy Iovine, the founder of Interscope Records. She met him through venture capitalist Drew Lipsher, and, as she puts it, "He has opened the door to many people for me." Not long after they met, he gave her a large chunk of change to invest in a startup she was launching called Desi Hits, a media company that produced and distributed entertainment for the South Asian community. A few months later, she and Iovine were sitting at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. That's when he told her the truth, that the startup wasn't going to work out and that he was going to stop funding it. But, he stressed, he was investing in her. Iovine was right. Desi Hits didn't work out the way Acharya wanted it to, at least not financially. But it did help her hone herself as an entrepreneur, and through it, she expanded her network. Since then, she and Iovine have invested in other projects, most notably launching the career of Bollywood actress Priyanka Chopra in the United States. Chopra, who starred in Quantico, became the first South Asian network TV drama star. She made history. And so did Acharya. Chapter 18. How to make a smart ask as a superconnector. We know this sounds like a no-brainer. Who doesn't know how to ask for something? You open your mouth and spew, right? Wrong. Most people are terrible askers. They don't realize that there is a methodology to making an ask. While some people believe in chance or luck, superconnectors use intention. After all, if you go around asking everyone you know for help, or if you make the wrong ask at the wrong time, it can seem transactional. Or you could risk making a gross error in judgment. You can say the wrong thing, or come off with bad or underhanded intentions. So you want to make sure the people you're making asks of share your values, goals, and vision. Some of the world's biggest deals and careers have been built on nothing more than smart asks and inbound referrals. These are the two biggest tools a connector has in their arsenal. These are the simple yet effective ways connectors receive value. They are the meat and potatoes. But though these tools seem simple, most people don't have a clue how to use them right. That's because they tend to view relationships transactionally, which gets them nowhere. Remember David Hassel? He's the guy who ran the Mansion series out of his ginormous San Francisco home. He had recently started a company called 15-5, an intercompany employee feedback system. He raised capital from 40 different investors in 60 days. Yes, 2 months. How did he do it? By never treating people as if they were just oversized wallets. Your relationships and your connections aren't necessarily the place to make money, says Hassel. In some cases they can be, but I don't think about relationships transactionally. Instead, I view them as one source of power or capital that can help in the process of creating other things. Many of the people who invested in his company were strangers to him, who signed on after one 20-minute phone call. But his reputation and connections proved his viability. He was a known quantity, trusted. And trust is transferable, he says. Say I know an investor who's close with someone I'm close with, and they have a tight relationship, and I have a tight relationship with the person. Now, the investor has never heard of me, doesn't know my name, we've never met. But when this person introduces me and says, look, I've known Dave for 3 years. He and I have done X, Y, and Z. He's a great guy, very trustworthy. It's like the trust he's built with this investor now transfers to me. And all he had to do was ask. Here are some things that have happened to us as a result of our asks. we were introduced to a very specific chief executive and in turn ended up with a deal that has since generated millions of dollars with millions more to come. We have been introduced to countless vendors that have served us incredibly well over the years and helped us avoid huge time sucks and bad vendor experiences. YEC was the lead feature story on the cover of the New York Times Sunday Business section. Twice. We raised several million dollars in funding for our business. We were able to get an A-list celebrity to attend one of our YEC events at no cost to us. And he had a fantastic time. The right ask to someone in Scott's network, a tweet ask, no less, resulted in a new partnership that will generate millions of dollars. All this because we asked the right someone at the right time for the right help. Of course, you've got to be, dare we say it, self-aware. And yes, that requires a bit of inventory. Here are some questions to ask yourself. Is the person I'm going to make an ask of the right person to make the intro I'm seeking? Just because someone can help or wants to help doesn't mean they should or that they'll be received by the end party positively. Does someone who does not understand anything about my industry or business or whatever understand my ask? Basically, do people think I'm being clear? What context am I not offering that I should? After all, if I want to talk to someone in my city, but I don't make that clear, I can end up getting an intro to someone in a different city, which ultimately makes for a bad experience for everyone, from the person I'm being introduced to the person who made the intro on my behalf. Can I figure this challenge out myself or through an available means so I don't waste social capital on a simple ask? The point is, assess, assess, assess. Don't just turn and speak. Don't make random requests. Analyze, critique, and validate. Then make your ask. Bad asks. We once got a call from an entrepreneur in the professional services industry. He was looking for capital. What kind? We asked. Angel investor, he replied. We stopped in our tracks. He had a great business, but angels clearly weren't going to invest because the investment return profile wasn't there. It was obvious that he was asking for the wrong kind of capital. So instead, we offered to introduce him to alternative lenders who were not looking to invest in exchange for equity, but rather looking to underwrite a loan at a higher interest rate. He took the loan instead of searching out equity financing, which saved him a ton of time and needless rejection. In the process, he was able to make his business cash flow positive and never raise capital. Had he gone after his original ask, he would likely have spent many months without getting anywhere and gotten only very frustrated, perhaps even developed insecurities about the strength of his business. All because he was making the wrong ask. The thoughtless, lazy ask. Ryan's pet peeve is when someone says, "Does anyone know someone at X company?" and then gives zero info beyond that. Ryan will think, yeah, maybe I do, but why should I connect you? What value do you bring? And are you going to use the connection I make for you in a genuine, mutually beneficial purpose or simply try to sell them on something they don't need? It's a totally vague, useless question. If you're the one looking for help, you must be specific about your needs. Some people don't want to go into detail because they believe that whatever they're working on is top secret. We understand why you wouldn't want to broadcast your project to the world. But if you're asking a favor of someone and not willing to be open about what you are looking for, that's a problem. And kind of stupid. Your ask defines you not only to the person to whom you are asking, but also to the future party who may or may not be connected to you. If you ask for something that sounds nonsensical, you're basically pigeonholing yourself and, for sure, setting a bad impression. Sometimes people just have poorly thought out or half-baked asks. Other times, people offer a lot of information about themselves, but no information about why a connection is synergistic and makes any sense. And sometimes, there is a lot of information given, but none that's actually relevant. If you want someone to make an important connection on your behalf, then you give them more information up front. This goes back to what we talked about earlier as far as doing things. Say, conducting certain marketing exercises like spammy emails that they themselves would never take interest in. The same thing applies here. If you wouldn't help someone who has your ask, or didn't understand what someone with your ask was asking, why would you even pop the question? For instance, at X company, you may think that the CEO is the one who can solve your problem best, when in reality, it's someone three rungs down the ladder. Unless you provided that extra context to someone with an in at the company, you'd be connecting to the wrong person, and you'd probably walk away with nada. Parag Marate, Chief Strategy Officer and Executive Vice President of Football Operations for the San Francisco 49ers, has pretty strong feelings about this. I would have to have a number of conversations with somebody before I make an introduction for them, he says. I get asked all the time, can you make an introduction to this or that person? A lot of times I'll say yes, but I'll give it with a caveat that I'm not going to be able to give some really effusive, praiseworthy recommendation because I don't really know you. How to make a good ask. Make sure your ask is structured and context-rich. Remember our discussion about context conversations? The conversations that give extra detail around a particular topic? Well, now you are using these protocols on yourself to make sure you're delivering a robust, context-rich ask that minimizes confusion and maximizes the chances for success. So, say you're looking to meet a person at a particular company. If you've done your due diligence and you know for a fact that the decision maker you're trying to reach is Paul, then you ask for him and explain why. But rather than saying, can you introduce me to Paul Smith at XYZ company? You say, I'm looking to learn what decision makers at enterprise companies in the X industry are looking for when assessing new vendors, so I can better prepare our business's marketing and pitch materials. I know you work with a number of these companies daily. Do you know someone who is a mid-level or senior manager with decision-making ability who might be able to spare 15 minutes? Be concise. If you can't make it clear in 30 seconds what you are looking for and why, in a simple, straightforward, and concise manner, don't say anything at all. You should lead with what you are trying to achieve, what the result you are looking for is, and not the means by which you want to get there. Erica Keswin is a workplace strategist, professional dot connector, and founder of the Spaghetti Project, which she calls a roving homespun huddle. It's a real-life spaghetti meal where people gather together to meet, share some pasta, and talk about what they need. I tell people, the more specific you can be, the easier it is for people to help you, says Keswin, a former executive recruiter. You need to do some thinking and have a shtick. The more general the ask, the less likely it is that they're going to say yes and even be able to help you. Target the right person. You need to find a specific person, type of person, or resource you want to be connected to. One of Scott's most hated questions is, do you know the CEO of X company? That's because it assumes that the top dog is always the right dog, when most times it's the wrong person, and, as the potential connector, makes us think that the asker seeks only to meet big names. This is usually a big red flag. Sometimes there are exceptions to the rule of always having to know exactly what you need when you ask for help, like when you're asking for mentorship on a topic you don't know the first thing about. In these cases, a little humility in your ask is important. An example. Hey, Scott and Ryan, I know diddly about community building, but I think it would be a great investment for me to know more to support my business. This is a much better approach than being the sort of person who pretends to know more than they actually do. make the other person a thought partner with you. You might know what you are looking for, but do you know how to get that end result? If not, who are the people you trust to bring in as thought partners? People who can help you structure your ask when you aren't exactly sure how to get to the end result. An example. You may want to get a book published, but going to any publisher might not make sense. Instead of asking a friend who has been published for a direct intro to their editor, it might make more sense to have a conversation with that person to learn the best approach, what makes for the right publisher fit, what a book proposal looks like, and so on. The person might be able to help with an intro if it makes sense, or the advice might help you find the right person to open a door using the new information. The people who do the best with asking are the people who do their research and really think about what it is that they want, but also figure out a way to make the other person a thought partner with you, says Michael Roderick. Setting realistic and achievable expectations. Starting off with a high-reach goal is never a good way to start a relationship. Like time commitments, this can be another reason the other party opts out beforehand. You shouldn't seek a grand slam on call one. Be clear on the time commitment involved. Many people miss this step, and then the party you're looking to connect with ends up opting out because they assume this will involve a massive time commitment on their part. By making the time commitment clear in your initial ask, the party you want to connect with will become more comfortable with saying yes because they know what they're saying yes to up front. The win-win ask. How did Elliot Bisnow and his team get people to invest $40 million on his mountain retreat? I asked, he says. That's true. But he didn't stand on the street corner brandishing a sign saying, "Wanna invest in my mountain?" Instead, he brought the idea to people who would mutually benefit from what he was going to ask them. Everyone Bisnow reached out to shared a common vision and goal. There was no other place out there like what Elliot was envisioning, a mountaintop in Utah, and so he recruited his community through smart asks. How to be sure you're making the right ask. Before making an ask, there are a series of questions to ask yourself in advance. Am I ready to make an ask for someone? Is there a high likelihood of success? Are you asking the right person? How well do you know the person? How well do they know you? Have you ever made an ask of this person before? Were they receptive to the ask? If they were, what was the outcome? Stellar or mediocre? Then there's the ask itself, which is also easy to get wrong if you don't take the time to really think it through. If you don't structure your ask, you look silly and unprofessional, and it leaves a bad taste in people's mouths. Is it reasonable or even doable? Can you do it yourself? Is the information readily available? If someone sees a lazy ask, they might think less of you as a person. You don't want to waste social capital on something that's not quite right. How to make the right ask of the right person. Once you are clear that you've found the right person, you need to make sure you are communicating with them in a way that they understand. Some factors to keep in mind. Do you speak the same language? Oftentimes, when making an ask of someone, you're crossing into uncharted territory, dealing with industrial, geographical, or political landscapes you don't understand. If you don't understand their world, even in the most basic of ways, the likelihood of even scratching the surface of getting what you want is low. So you always want to be clear and make sure other people think you are being clear. You'd be surprised how many things seem obvious to you, but are anything but to the people you are talking to. Timing. It's a natural extension of speaking the same language. The timing in which you make your ask is critical in both the micro and the macro senses. If you're making an ask of a parent with multiple kids under the age of 5, don't call them on the phone at 6:30 on a weeknight. If you're making an ask of a top executive at Target, maybe don't do it on Black Friday. The medium. Before reaching out, find out the most appropriate form of communication for the person you're reaching out to and the favor you're looking for. Email, phone call, a tweet, a handwritten letter. In our world, we have created friendships with many tastemakers with large online followings. If, say, we needed their help promoting something through a quick tweet to their network, a quick text or email might be just fine. If we wanted to launch a large multi-channel marketing campaign with them that puts heavy time constraints on both their time and ours, well, we damn well better pick up the phone and get more personal. Maybe even meet in person for a cup of coffee. Or a steak, depending on what you're after. On your tab, of course. Knowing what you actually need and why you need it. A good asker always knows what they want and why they want or need it. And even more, they show up prepared, with detailed information to back it up if they need it. Super concierge Steve Sims wholeheartedly agrees with this tactic. If I want something, it's gotta benefit you, he says. I've gone to people and said, I want this to happen. My message is transparent. There's a difference between being easy to understand and impossible to misunderstand. I don't want you to ever misunderstand what I want. In LA, no one is direct. But I don't have a half hour to waste. Tell me, what do you have? What do you want to do? Conveying your thoughts or message in your own words. Since this is your request, you want to make it as easy as possible for everyone involved. So you should offer to write a short 3-to-5-sentence email outlining the ask, something that can be easily forwarded. By offering this, you're removing a friction point from the connector and getting your own words in front of the party you're looking to connect with. It's also a great way to ensure that what you're trying to say doesn't get lost in a game of telephone. This puts your best foot forward because it's your foot and has a very high likelihood of being read by the other party based on the relationship that person has with the connector. Follow up, but don't overpush. As we said earlier in this book, you want to follow up smartly. You don't want to overpush or make people feel like they work for you. Roderick, the teacher-turned-Broadway producer, recalls the old friend he thought would be a perfect person to get involved in a show that Roderick was working on. So Roderick sent him an email, laying out everything he needed. He didn't hear anything, so he sent another. And then another. Finally, he received an email back, saying that this guy had lost his job, that his wife had cancer, that all of these horrible things had happened to him, says Roderick. It basically taught me a very valuable lesson, which is that if somebody in your network goes cold, you never, never, never reach out asking for something until you know exactly what's going on with them and how their life is and what's happening, because it can be incredibly damaging. In other words, if you don't hear from someone, don't pester them, tempting though it may be. None of us likes it when our emails go unanswered. But guess what? Sometimes it's not about us. Now that you know when and how to make an ask, let's go through some things to ensure it's the right move. Reverse engineering success. Your job is to take on as much of the heavy lifting as possible and to eliminate any possible friction that might impede success. You want to make it as convenient and simple as possible for both the connector and the party you're seeking a connection with to receive and digest your request, and ultimately meet to further discuss and fulfill the ask. In order to properly reverse engineer success, you need to troubleshoot an ask and ask yourself one simple question. Why will my ask fail? This will help you improve or clarify your ask, dissuade you from making a half-baked or bad ask, and give you the confidence to proceed. Here's how Ingrid Vandervelt reverse engineered a successful ask to get into the role of EIR. When she first went in to pitch Steve Felice, whom she met back at Dwen, she shared with him the vision she had to empower 1 billion women by 2020. She knew that the only way to accomplish that vision was through technology. She was seeking a global tech partner to collaborate with who was equally committed to the success of women around the globe. "My interest was to secure Dell as a partner," Vandervelt said. "But I also approached the meeting by saying, 'Steve, here is how I can be of service to you all.' I knew Dell cared about women. I knew they cared about entrepreneurs, and at the time, they were really known as an enterprise company. But they wanted to change that perception. And I knew that in working together, I could create programs by and for people like me as an entrepreneur, or as a woman, that would authentically connect." She told Felice, "I know that I can tap Dell into a community of women and entrepreneurs around the globe who will help you authentically connect to them and ultimately drive business." Vandervelt pitched Felice on the EIR program. This was how she would be able to drive value and be of service to Dell. Felice saw the potential, and he also shared her vision of helping not only women around the globe, but all entrepreneurs in general. So Dell chose to bring her on board. Felice, along with the help of leaders at Dell like Jennifer J.J. Davis, provided guidance and insight into what would work for Dell, and Ivy created the EIR program, soup to nuts. Vandervelt's agreement with Dell was, "Okay, you help us do what we want to do on the entrepreneur side and the women's side, and if we are successful at that, it will automatically help achieve the goal that I have for myself." Vandervelt says her time at Dell reiterated so much of what she had learned in working on big ideas in life and in business. The people who are doing big things in the world, who are authentic connectors, who are people who fundamentally show up and say, "Here's how I can help you, here's how you can help me, and here are the timeline and the deliverable," she says. "Those are the people that tie the service and the ROI piece into the same interaction to get the result they want. And it's a win-win for both sides." Ingrid was able to achieve her goal of having Dell's support, which she credits as key to being able to do the work she does today with empowering 1 billion women by 2020. With EBW 2020, she now has a company that came about as a result of her services there. And she did it all by reverse engineering her success. Chapter 19. How to Build Consistent Referrals. As a super connector, over time, your community will naturally make referrals. Your job is to train people on what makes for great referrals and build natural moments which your network refers to regularly. Investing in your own referral network. The more you invest your time, focus on your anchors and others whom you trust, and rely on referrals, the better quality your inbound referrals will be. If you're the local accountant, like Jim Pierce, it's probably best to build relationships with people you deem to be the best service providers in your area, from lawyers to doctors to landscapers. People you share an audience or customer base with. By consistently working with the best, and more important, heavily investing in the relationships beyond surface-level conversations, you begin to build a referral network. We've found that when people mutually invest in each other over time, long-term mutual value will be created. The best referrals always come from the people who know you best. And the more time and history you have with someone, the closer you become in both life and business. The call to talk to people and offer assistance is what opens the door to the conversation about getting their trigger events. Derek Coburn does this so he can introduce the idea of trigger events to his network. Once he can help them define their trigger phrases, he can be of service to him. This also naturally enables him to speak about these trigger phrases and offer them his. By educating them on how he can make better referrals to them, he is also able to make clear how they can do the same when an opportunity presents itself. Coburn also schedules 15-minute interviews with really good clients and key people in his network and asks them a handful of questions. A big one. What's the top challenge or opportunity you're focused on right now? A lot of us have people in our network or clients that we serve, he says, but we often don't know much about them. We know they own an IT company, and that's about all we know, he says. We don't know who they primarily provide their service for. What's the size of the company in terms of revenue or employees they like to target? If I have a key person in my network who runs an IT company providing tech services, and I refer them to a company that has only 25 employees, yet the ideal minimum for their company is 100, then I'm not adding value. I'm actually wasting their time. I'm doing worse than adding value. Trigger phrases and trigger events. This is the perfect opportunity for Coburn to educate them on how to get better referrals, which can help their businesses, as well as to share his own keywords. And since he is the person who first brought this to their attention, it's more likely that he'll remain top of mind. The concept of triggering events stems from the term trigger phrase, which marketing expert John Jantz discusses in his book, The Referral Engine. What are trigger events or phrases? They are, essentially, the phrases that indicate someone may need your services at some point. The easiest way to describe to someone what a trigger event or trigger phrase is? By giving them examples from my own business, Coburn says. What that does is help introduce them to this concept that I think will really help them and benefit them while they're out and about telling their key influencers and clients, here's what you need to be on the lookout for when recommending people to me or referring people to me. An example of a trigger phrase for me is, I have been managing my own money and don't have time to keep up with it, says Coburn. Most people are not going to say, I need a great financial advisor, or I need an introduction to a financial advisor. They may say, I'm thinking about selling my business in a year. So that's one of the key phrases that he has people in his network pay attention to. He consistently reinforces these phrases with his network, so he remains top of mind. A trigger phrase would reflect perhaps a triggering event, Coburn says. Perhaps something that has happened in life. For example, someone is getting ready to sell a business, which they tell you about 6 months before they even need you. Figure out good triggering phrases for your business and then help your clients figure out triggering phrases to listen for in their own business, he says. You can teach your clients how to do this by giving examples of what phrases you would be looking for. This also teaches the clients to listen for trigger phrases on your behalf. Even though the client interviews are for learning about your clients, you can teach clients and friends how to help you. Creating a frictionless environment. Coburn holds customer appreciation wine tasting events. His events, and consequently his business, are all built on referrals, just like John Levy's dinners. Ditto for Jason Gaynard, who gets thousands of inbound applications from people who want to attend his mastermind talks. Guests are welcome to bring guests. In fact, he encourages them to do so. Not in a creepy or insincere way, just as a way to meet new people. This is all very deliberate. By being seen as the facilitator and bringing in the right guests, natural conversations ensue. You know how it goes. If you've been invited to a high-quality event, you'll naturally ask the person who brought you certain questions. What's this event about? Who's the host? How do you know him or her? What do they do? These sorts of questions are likely to fuel positive responses, praise, and context-rich conversations that help your guest sell you without selling at all. There's no magic here. They're just talking as they normally would. but the framework of the environment is what makes this possible. And this is all because Coburn set up the framework for the event correctly. Creating the right environment, inviting the right group, making the right clear asks to hone the guest list, being viewed as the facilitator to establish credibility and authority, enabling clients to then speak about him and further establish his credibility and results, and finally, creating moments to be brought into warm conversations and referrals. If I'm investing my time and money into deepening existing relationships, especially if there's a recurring revenue place for my business, then it's still a great use of my time and money, even if I don't end up getting a new client or great new connection, he says. And it's never a bad thing to concentrate on your best relationships. The more you add value to their lives and provide guidance on trigger phrases and triggering events, the more likely you are to increase their desire to reciprocate. Finally, you want to make sure people can easily get in touch with you online. If you've built strong Facebook forums or LinkedIn groups or other digital communities, it's important to make sure people can easily get a hold of you. Make sure it's easy to contact you, whether via email, Facebook Messenger, or something else. Don't lose out on being recommended because your digital communities don't know how to connect with you in the real world. We know. Social media can easily become a distraction, and for most, it's a detractor from productivity. Superconnectors, like all individuals online these days, need good rules in place to ensure that the time spent connecting with others online doesn't take away from time spent working on building your life, in real life. We both have specific times during the day when we check and answer connections on social media. For example, Ryan spends about 15 minutes in the morning scanning his feeds, answering messages, and looking for new opportunities while commuting into the office. The rest of the day, you'll rarely see him engaging with Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, or otherwise. These are his rules. It's up to you to come up with your own, so social media doesn't dominate your life. How to train your community to refer the right opportunities your way. Like all of the people we interviewed for this book, Derek Coburn is really smart. He is so smart, in fact, that he has figured out a way that his anchors can sell him in a natural, non-sleazy, used car salesman kind of way on a regular basis. In effect, they are doing the work on his behalf. In addition to being an author, Coburn also owns a wealth management business and is the founder of Cadre, an un-networking community in Washington, D.C., that serves CEOs and business leaders. As mentioned, he also holds high-end customer appreciation wine tasting events. Coburn stresses that these events are not marketing events in disguise. He throws them truly to thank his clients, but he does give a 10 to 15 minute talk on a relevant financial topic. Why do this? So people can put a face to the person throwing the extravaganza. So he can provide extra advice to his clients, and to demonstrate his expertise. His efforts have paid off. During his first year holding these events, it was common for nearly 50% of his non-clients to reach out to him after the events. He generated nearly $150,000 in revenue, much of which came from people he encountered when they attended one of his events. People he most likely never would have otherwise met. The necessity of teamthink around the importance of connecting. Superconnectors build referrals into the fabric of what they do and the remarkable experiences they conduct. But the anchor effect, which we talked about earlier, also plays a role. You can extol your many virtues until those proverbial cows come home. But when someone else does it on your behalf, now you've arrived. Parag Marate talks a lot about the importance of hiring connectors. By hiring and training connectors, you dramatically increase the number of smarter asks and referrals that benefit the whole. More important than looking for bullet points on a resume, you're looking for people with exceptional personal attributes because, again, It comes down to culture, and it comes down to when you know that the sum of the parts is much greater than the individual pieces, he says. Superconnectors always have a simple and consistent ask, so it's easy to remember and to execute, and it works with word of mouth. In our case, it was always, if you know a phenomenal young entrepreneur we should know about for YEC, let us know. At YEC, we are constantly training the people around us in our belief system. Whether you're a business owner or climbing the corporate ladder, if you can share your beliefs with everyone and not just espouse niceties, you create magnets. Let's go back to John Rulin, the gifting guru. His natural talent of giving gifts to others is so extraordinary, methodically, at scale, that he is able to attract referrals by staying top of mind with individuals who are just purely impressed. And he stokes the system by constantly investing part of the money he makes into his relationships, which only further fuels the engine. Jim Pierce never saw any value in chamber events from a networking perspective. As far as he was concerned, they were strictly for people with something to pitch and sell, which turned him off. Most people go to networking events just to sell, he says. They're not spending time developing a relationship with anyone. They're there to pass out business cards and calendars. So what did he do? Instead of never returning, he turned the real estate on its head. Knowing that people who attended chamber events were motivated to sell and make money, he decided to see who was best at it. He then asked them to sell for him and refer customers to him. This helped his business, built a relationship with new people, and turned what was largely a time waste into a value add, simply by applying his own rules to the real estate that was in front of him. Indeed, one of the best feelings in the world is when someone thinks highly enough of you to recommend you for anything. It's like when someone wants to set you up on a blind date with one of their friends. If they didn't think well of you, they would never recommend you. Right? It's someone else advertising you or your services without your having to do a thing. The best superconnectors know how to build their networks on referrals alone, just like we did with YEC. When people talk well about you, it's the ultimate compliment. Epilogue. Superconnections. Over the years, we have both been fortunate to be mentored by truly amazing people who have given us terrific advice. We often look back on some of the advice we've been given. Build a real business that makes real cash. Don't believe your own PR. Hire smarter people than you, but make sure they share your ethics and morals. You can't automate your humanity. It takes years to build your reputation and seconds to destroy it. They're all quite profound. But nearly 13 years later, one thing in particular has resonated. Words of wisdom from one of Scott's mentors, Holly Pep. Real success, she told him, takes real time. When he asked why, her response came swiftly. Because you can't fake or cheat real time. At that moment, Scott didn't fully appreciate how wise that simple sentence was. In fact, big shock, he barely even heard it. In typical Scott fashion, he started debating Holly and asking questions like, well, how do I speed up progress? How can I get to point C faster without point B? Holly was around captains of industry regularly. Surely she knew how they did it better and faster, says Scott. Surely she knew how they made their mark in half the time. But what she told me was even wiser, which I realized very quickly meant that the people who were trying to cheat or have the time were actually the people fooling themselves and wasting their time. They weren't smarter or more efficient. They were fools. They were peddling fiction. The smartest captains of industry realized quickly that you can't cheat time. So they maximized every minute to build the relationships that would ultimately define their lives and careers. The true secret? that there was no secret. Most people don't believe this, which has allowed those who do get it to rise to the top. We are surrounded by false messages, get-rich-quick schemes, and billion-dollar unicorn startups that promise the world. In our excitement, we forget that Santa Claus doesn't exist, there was no wizard in Oz, and there is no such thing as overnight success. Holly's simple statement has since informed every relationship Scott has made and every step he's taken as a businessman and connector. Every time he found himself wanting to push a boundary or trying to move something along faster, he would use Holly's words as a mantra to stop what he was doing, take a deep breath, and ask himself if he was being ambitious or reckless. This wasn't just in business, but in personal relationships too. If there's one thing we want you to take away from this book, it's that there isn't a magic formula or loophole to become successful at anything. You can't cheat real time. You can't hack relationships. You're cheating only yourself. And to cheat real time is to waste time, doing the very networking type tasks we've been preaching against throughout this book. Whenever you try to do so, or more precisely, every time you're told time can be defeated, take a deep breath and a giant step back. But there is something else, too. As we noted, the genesis of networking is dead in part involves the arrival of social media, instant gratification technology, and our 21st century addiction to technology. You all know what we're talking about. That itch to check the number of likes you got on the photos you posted from your recent trip to the Grand Canyon. Or live tweeting the last episode of The Bachelor, only to realize that you're devoting less energy to watching the show and are instead focused on reading and responding to your Twitter feed. As with everything, if you do it in moderation, you're all good. But when these behaviors start taking precedence over the things happening in real life, then it's time for an intervention. We want to urge you to utilize the same level of caution on your journey to becoming a super connector, because making connections is addictive. As you begin to develop these, dare we call them, superpowers, you will start seeing the world through new lenses. Where opportunity once was concealed, you'll start seeing it pop up where you least expect it. And like a newly drafted Pokemon Go player, you'll be yearning to catch them all. As Adam Grant mentioned, both the most and the least successful people are givers. The defining factor that separates one from the other is boundaries, or knowing when to say no. Being able to set good boundaries as a super connector will drive success not only in your professional life, but in your personal life as well. We interviewed many super connectors for this book. Each one put heavy weight on how important their personal, untethered time was. Whether that was time with family and significant others, indulging in independent films, or camping in the wilderness, these moments of separation from the superconnector lifestyle are what kept them grounded to the world and what's really important in life. I've seen what can happen when the superconnector part of my life bubbles into the areas of my life where I spend time with the people that I cherish the most. My wife, my kids, my parents, my friends, says Ryan. At times, checking my phone was like taking a breath. During family dinners, while watching cartoons with my kids, while having a beer with my best buddies at the bar, the endless opportunity at the tip of my fingers became an addiction. He even remembers certain holidays where he'd sneak off to the bathroom to check his emails. And then he realized that this was not productive to his well-being. How did Ryan change? By putting his phone out of reach when he got home from work. A simple strategy that anyone can do, but that all too often nobody does. He started telling himself, this can wait until tomorrow. Which again, in our fast-paced world, many of us choose to forget. Even though it can. He even began embracing a more minimalist lifestyle to offset the overabundance that the life of a superconnector can sometimes create. Less stuff in his home, fewer planned activities, and more spontaneity. He is now in the process of buying a travel van so his family can spend time together off the grid, distraction-free. The moral is this. Being a superconnector is a wonderful way to live that will connect you to people and opportunities that you never